requested the service as the chair this afternoon, so I'll do my best. I'm going to ask each of the panellists to say very, very briefly who they are, but also why they think they're here and what it is that they feel they can contribute to this conversation. So I'll kick off and say who I am. I'm an architect.
Sorry, who are you?
I'm Robert. I'm an architect and an educationalist. I suppose I've been involved in working in areas of change and deprivation for quite a long time, from working in former Soviet Union, working in West Belfast, working in Cuba. But most recently, I've been working on projects in what might be described as the European refugee crisis. So from Lesbos, northern Greece, Calais, and I'm still involved in that discourse. That led me to do a couple of things, which I think is why I'm here. One was a festival at the Barbican in the summer called Papers, where we brought together all of the artists, architects, theorists, refugees and volunteers working in the Calais camp at the time. And we locked them in a room for a day in the Barbican, and we asked them to talk to each other and answer some of the questions that I think we're talking about today. What is the role of the arts? What is the role of culture? What is the role of theory in relation to issues that are as pressing and as vital as the refugee crisis in Palestine? I then went on to create two shows at the South Bank this summer in the Festival of Love. One looked at the urbanism of the Calais jungle, and the other was a project that brought Blue House, which was the first house in Calais, to London, to try to find a way of bringing its author, the artist Alpha, to London, which we still haven't done yet. I'm now working on a project again, for the Nordic Festival next summer, on the Sami, on the tribespeople of the Nordic regions, all the way from Norway, right the way through to the Kola Peninsula, whose treatment over hundreds of years echoes many of the themes that we're talking about. Well, that's why I'm here. So would you do the same?
Yes, my name's Ib Haim, from Architects and Planners for Justice in Palestine, which is a group that formed about 8 years ago to challenge Israeli architects who were actually building the settlements against, you know, the whole ethics of architecture that totally contravened, you know, all the professionalism and the morals and ethics that architects have to have, which is to serve the whole of society. And raise this whole issue of what Israel is doing and where the settlements and, you know, the whole takeover of Palestine is actually an architectural issue. And architect has become a sort of an instrument of violence rather than for social good. So we've been raising the whole issue on the international stage. We've got the RIBA to actually pass a motion to suspend Israel at the International Union of Architects. And we've also faced the challenge of the Israel lobby, who came in full force, you know, in every issue and in every way to actually reverse that. So what Yara and Nasser are doing, actually the constructive side of it, because we had originally thought that we need to get students of architecture to take on projects that were connected with, you know, this whole issue. And almost perfectly, Yara and Nasser are actually doing this in an amazing way in the universities, you know, and again, to the great chagrin of the Israel lobby. And, you know, just challenging this whole issue of colonialism and the fragmentation of a country. And, you know, the stitching together again, as they've said, is a most wonderful issue in which Architects and Planners for Justice in Palestine are supporting entirely. So that's why I'm here.
I'm Dr. Harriet Harris. I run the PhD programme at the Royal College of Arts in Architecture and Interior Design. I'm, I suppose, more renowned for some of the books I've written on architecture education, radical pedagogies and so on. And I think my connection, why I'm here, is actually to do with one of my more recent projects, which was getting students to design. And you may have seen it because it's on the BBC News and across, in fact, 100 media channels around the world, a coat that converts into a tent, that converts into a sleeping bag for use by refugees, regardless of where they were from. Again, arriving by sea to land in places like Greece. And I think that, you know, more broadly, my work concerns the big question about how we teach students to care about situations like this. How do we shift the agenda in architectural education away from designing for the privileged to those who have nothing and aren't necessarily paying clients? And really what our priorities are as architects in relation to civic engagement and the crucial question around the invisibility of ethics within our profession. And that's not just reaching refugees, that is how we treat each other in terms of representation crisis we currently have within the profession.
Hi, my name is Yahya Zalloum. I'm director of P21 Gallery on the other side of the London. P21 was established in 2012 to promote art and culture related to the Arab world. And we are part of the Qalandia International by giving platform for the film screening program.
My name is Mark Gaskin. I'm head of the School of Architecture. I've known Yara for a few years. I've known NASA for couple of decades. I used to give him all my students who couldn't draw, because he's very good at teaching students how to draw, but that's evolved now. I was particularly keen that at part two level that they brought an agenda into Brooks that dealt with design and these issues rather than just the theory of these issues. We're quite a unique school of architecture, as we have in a place called the Centre for Development Emergency Practice. Which is very much punches above its weight and works in disaster management zones, but they were always masters in theory, not so much applied into practice. So the idea was to get this applied into practice. So Nasser and Yara brought it into practice, and you saw one of the results of that today. And I'm an educator and an architect. I am in no way an expert in this field, but I like the fact that I've been made aware, far more aware of this over 20 years. Primarily through Nasser and Yara, but by other people as well. And I've written down something that I tend to, as I find I get older, I'm less selective in the information. I feed off information, but I'm less selective about the information that I get, but I'm more appalled by the information that I'm beginning to receive. So I've always felt that education is a very important part of, before you become professionals, you first of all get educated. How you get educated does affect how you act as a professional in these areas. So it is about our job, I think, is to make people aware of these issues while they're being educated and make them kind of activists for change, really, if you like.
My name is Anthony Downey, and I'm the professor of visual culture in the Middle East and North Africa at Birmingham City University, which is a relatively new appointment. But I'm also the editor-in-chief of a publication called IBRAZ, which is an online publication research initiative. And we are the media partners for Qalandia International, and we were asked to do this some months ago. And it was a great opportunity for us to come together and think about how you disseminate information about a site which invariably the majority of us in this room will not be able to visit. The other element, and I think the reason why Nasser and I spoke thereafter, was to think about my own professional research, which is very much about the way in which contemporary art makes claims on political realities which are very hard to actually substantiate, and why they make those claims, why institutions and why artists are increasingly encouraged to engage with notions of dispossession and disaffection, notions of refugee status and so forth, and what happens in that moment that contemporary art engages with these. My concern, briefly put, is that the culturalization of these issues is often a way of neutralizing their political impact. And the one thing that interests me is whose interests are being served in the moment of devolving political debate into the sphere of culture. Hence, talking about Ai Weiwei, but there are many other artists that one could have talked about. Thank you.
My name is Nalko, I'm an artist. I work with various mediums. I wasn't expecting to be on the panel, so excuse me. for this little introduction, but I had a presentation earlier.
My name is Sarah Bellington. I think probably most of you saw the presentation I gave earlier. I have been making work. I'm an artist, visual artist, and a filmmaker, and I have been involved in making work related to Palestine for 10 years, as well as other projects. And the main project I'm working on now is really about the right of return in relation to the refugees, the Palestinian refugees. And I've been working a lot in a refugee camp in Beirut, Borja Barajni camp, where the main subject of my feature-length documentary lives. And she is an educator herself. She is the head of a primary school that she founded. And really, I'm trying to make a film at the moment that talks about memory, that talks about hauntings in the landscape, and how to reimagine, how to create a space that return might be possible. I think that's enough.
Yeah. I'm Tehlike Shukeri-Thos, I'm a performer and theatre maker, and along with Julian from Station House Elfborough, we're working on a project called At Home in Gaza and London that started shortly after the 2014 offensive. We've been in collaboration with artists from various disciplines in Gaza for a while, and the main aim is to connect London and Gaza, but also specifically a look into personal people's lives and experiences in Gaza due to us not seeing that, not getting it. There aren't enough artistic projects with Gaza, unfortunately, especially internationally. Usually the focus is on the West Bank, naturally, because there's more access to the West Bank. And so through the digital techniques that Julian has developed over several years, we're able to finally work and collaborate with individuals in Gaza. On the 12th and 13th of November, we are sharing the work at Twenty Studios. Probably the work speaks for itself much better than either of us can talk about.
Well, Kathy, you said it all earlier. Yeah. My name's Julian Maynard Smith. I'm the director of this company, Station House, that's been doing performance for a long time now. This is, and I've worked on sort of video streaming and kind of global performance for a number of years, but it's the first time I've been involved with doing something with Palestine. So I'm very much a novice in this, and I don't want to set myself up as knowing anything particular about a particular situation. But I have sort of struggled over the years to try and work out how you can work with people in another place. And obviously, Gaza is a very particular place, and there's like obvious reasons why we're doing this kind of technological connection, because it just allows people there to work actively with people here, and we are trying to create a communal workspace. And what happens in that space, we don't know really. I mean, we're coming across all kinds of issues which are not to do with the Israeli occupation, but to do with cultural differences, all kinds of how you do kind of transcultural theatre and, you know, live, and it's really quite, you know, trying not to be colonial about it and saying, well, we come with this idea, trying not to just let anything go, trying to find a way that you meet, create.
I'm Nassos, I'm an architect from Cyprus. I'm currently practicing in London, and I've been assisting and teaching with Nasser and Yara in Westminster University last year. I developed also my thesis project with them in Oxford Brookes, and given the opportunity of teaching and also contributing in Open Gaza, I developed it further to explore these notions of representation and the virtual agora and the relationship between physical and virtual space and how it can be contested. So it's an ongoing exploration at the moment.
Okay, thank you. Well, that's us. I just want to find out who you are, because I want to start by just asking people to put their hands up if they've made a project, taught a project, or made an artwork, or a performance, or a piece of music that relates to migration, the refugee crisis, Palestine. Hands up. Okay, so we're going to talk about, we're going to start by trying to answer Anthony's question about complicity. Because we inherited two questions from the presentations. And Anthony, if I paraphrase you by saying the question you wanted us to address in relation to the role of creative practice is the representation and working with refugees, glasses on, whilst critiquing our own complicity in that situation by working in that way. Sarah, you're an artist. Can you explain how you deal with the accusation of complicity?
I think by spending a lot of time with the people that I'm trying to represent in some way, by not swooping in and swooping out, by trying to find a voice, by not imposing my voice and allowing the voice of the people that I'm working with to emerge, and also showing the material that I'm making back to them for them to critique what I'm doing, creating a dialogue between us. For instance, the performance that I did in Al Aujah off the Jordan Valley, that was very much a collaborative performance where I worked with the local Bedouin, I worked with local people from Jericho, and we talked about what might be appropriate and what they might like, even. So there was dialogue. It wasn't just imposing an artist from outside coming in and plopping something down and running away. It was a slow process.
So it's about time.
I think it's about time and trying to form dialogue and understanding, mutual understanding.
Yeah. Harriet, you've taught people and you've made projects. How do you deal with that? Does it worry you? Do you wake up in the middle of the night worrying about complicity?
Yeah, I do actually, quite literally. I think one of the problems is, there's a duty of care with students. You're exposing them to projects, but you're also, as we discovered, exposing them to the public's view of those projects. And there's a vulnerability in their exposure to something that's quite challenging emotionally for them. But also, again, the relationship with the people that they are supposedly designing for. I don't ever present projects that we do as being in any way a solution, in any way something that would negate a political strategy or negate the efforts of really effective NGOs. I think that the approach is to look at it and think about how design could make a small difference to a couple of material concerns. And if there's a social implication, that's great, but you can't really design that because that's coercion rather than complicity. So I think really briefs take a long time. There's such a sensitivity to the words that are chosen and in relation to the instructions that need to be considered very carefully. And because there is this double stakeholder dynamic, the students but also the people that you're designing for.
Anthony, are you convinced?
I don't think it's to me to be convinced or not. I would merely point out that there are a number of questions that have to be asked in a predicatory manner when you are working with, for example, refugees, the dispossessed, disaffected, disappeared, those who have been tortured, because that relationship is a very problematic one, and the complicity, the issue of complicity, is also an issue that I have to struggle with, and critics in general. There's a lot of money to be made in misery. There's a lot of money to be made in poverty. There's a lot of careers that have been made on these subjects. There are a lot of people, I know them, I work with them, and I'm not necessarily saying they're not self-reflexive, but this is now a career path, and it's a growing career path. And it's one of the few growth areas, believe it or not, in the humanities, is dealing with misery. And if you are an artist, if you are a critic, if you are someone who engages with these issues, I think it is absolutely, fundamentally a prerequisite that you question your motivation when you're doing that, but equally you question what happens to your work after that event. Now, can we come up with the answers to this? I'm not saying there are any clear answers. There, of course, are not any clear answers. But I would say if you're not asking the right questions from the outset, there is a danger that you will merely reify the very conditions that you're ostensibly critiquing.
I think that also depends on And artists are people who have to earn a living and they like to be famous. I mean, they're notorious egomaniacs, artists, basically. Ai Weiwei is a great artist, but he also is treading a line between being a socially engaged artist, political artist, and also a successful artist in the Western economy. I went to the Calais Jungle 2 years ago just because I wanted to see, and I came away not knowing what to do really at all. But the place had photographers all over it taking pictures, and they were just interested in taking images, and they weren't asking themselves what's going to happen to that image and if it's going anywhere. And I think, you know.
Yeah, a couple of things about complicity and what is just the opposite of that in terms of making art. It reminded me of the situation in Ramallah where during one of the defensive shield operations, you know, the IDF had imposed this complete, you know, blanket on the West Bank. And in Ramallah they went around, you know, with their tanks smashing all the cars in the streets. And what happened was the artists took all the smashed cars, you know, and created, you know, a piece out of it. Now that, there's a difference between that, using, you know, an actual incident and, you know, the reality of the occupation to create art, and the difference between, you know, Ai Weiwei, you know, who, you know, ostensibly is very, you know, sort of passionate about human rights, but then creates an image, you know, that glorifies and iconifies himself. But the other thing is, you know, the whole subject of the occupation is such a fascinating thing that it's used, you know, by academics, you know, to further their own careers, as you say, and, you know, they're sort of lots of people, you know, wanting to do theses. You know, I get lots of contacts from people saying, you know, they want to do this for their PhD and they want to do this for their thesis. And And there's a difference between that, you know, furthering their career, using it as a sort of an academic subject, and the difference between what Yara and Nasser are doing, which is, as Sarah says, working with the people and working to actually find solutions, lateral thinking about how do you sort of face such an impossible situation. And the actual opposite of what Yara and Nasser are doing is what Israel is doing, which is, instead of, they're trying to stitch up the West Bank, you know, whereas you are trying to stitch together, you know, the fragments of reality and, you know, trying to resist and oppose the occupation. What the Israelis are trying to do is just the opposite, is to stamp out any possibility, you know, where they take over all the land, they declare areas state land and create these archipelagos so that, you know, Palestinians have no chance for establishing a state. So this is the, you know, sort of dilemma of, and the question of, you know, what academics and artists have to do, you know, related to people, and what Salim himself is doing with his PhD, which is working with the people, with kids, you know, with his chalkboard, to come up with actual solutions to use this as a subversive and resistance, you know, to the occupation. Mm-hmm.
Any comments from the floor on complicity? When you speak, would you just say who you are? So, you know.
Yeah, my name is Don Fernando. I'm an architect and a sort of artist curator type of thing. We are from Wales, actually, 2 or 3 of us. We're building, we hope, very slowly, some sort of an exchange between East Jerusalem at the moment in the Al-Hosh Gallery. And we're working out how that can develop. But I think one of the critical elements for me would be, having been to Palestine, is to try and develop something which is mutually supportive. So that ultimately what we try to do, if we can, is to bring people to Wales and expose them to the history of Wales. As we might take children or young adults Palestine and expose them to the history of Palestine and see how that the two histories can be interrelated. So that it's a mutual development rather than a kind of exploitative one that I kind of witnessed over there with a lot of well-meaning people doing good work, but it seemed to be rather parasitic and rather exploitative and self-serving. So that's the kind of goal, really. And I think in relation to publicity, I think it's quite mutual development. I think if that can be achieved, I think that's, personally, I think that's the way forward.
Thank you. There was another question that came forward from Andreas in the presentation, and that was, I suppose, if there's a sense that concepts of air and sea and land are ways of reconceiving of the free space between existing structures, be they national or political or social, then there is a sort of parallel with that in terms of the role that media, the internet, social media can play in effectively being, as he described, the viable form of aid. Again, I'd like to just ask panelists to respond to that, specifically within, this, I suppose, the concept of the medium, the sense that there are different ways of tackling an issue which has become, I suppose, sticky in many ways, apropos our recent conversation. Media as aid.
Well, there's a danger, I think, with a lot of hypothetical, theoretical, or conceptual ideas, or academic or art projects. They, for the artist, giving yourself a sense of satisfaction and accomplishment. I've done this art project, but then what happens? So that's, who does it serve? And what is the real effect? So we create these amazing presentations and so on, but what happens to the communities and the land itself? And that's the danger, I think, because there is this sense of, I've done something related to Gaza and I'm done now, so I'm moving on to Calais, and oh, then I'm going to go to Lesbos, and I'm going to go to Kos, because Lesbos is, there are too many projects in Lesbos now.
And I suppose
it's really serious.
There's also the suggestion that aspects of using media allows things to happen much more quickly.
Yeah.
Rather than as a artistic medium, I think it's, is there actually a way of establishing paradigms of aid that are related to the use of media and the use of the internet? I think that was the question he was asking. There must be.
Well, I mean, social media is absolutely the only outlet that people in Gaza and the West Bank have, really, because everything is so restricted. I mean, Gaza is the biggest prison in the world. You know, everything is blockaded. So one of the key outlets must be social media and the internet. And this is one way that, first of all, and as part of your scheme of the Agora, is where people can interconnect within an area, which I think is what they're doing in Gaza, and can be used as a tool, as you say, for education, for connection, for sending a message out to the world. There have been so many photographers, for instance, who've been photographing and you know, sort of registering what is happening in Gaza by photography and sending that out to the world. So people, it's the best way for that to, you know, for the world to know what's going on. So I think it's certainly a major tool. And of course, Israel tries everything possible to, you know, stop this. I mean, how many Palestinian TV stations are being destroyed by Israel? The blocking of expanding the, you know, the internet, you know, the possibilities of setting up the internet and the network.
They have really strong internet, better than in London.
They do,
yes,
really.
It's great. Yeah, they're a connection. At the moment, we're working with the Al Mishal Theatre in Gaza, and yeah, we are. The network there is stronger than ours here. So that's the it is.
And also, what is happening in Gaza? There is a startup in Gaza where where they have got funding to produce apps and so on. So a lot of people. I mean, people are really well educated, as something pointed out in Gaza, and so there is a sort of industry, there's a kind of a growing media industry, which is obviously immune, more, you know, immune to the physical restrictions than most other things, because you can do it entirely online. So there's a possibility of an economic kind of function.
Yeah, Startup Sky Geeks, it's a startup accelerator, and so young entrepreneurs in Gaza are making livings just online.
There is a flip side to this, of course. Obviously, post-Snowden, what we have found, and it's interesting that the signal is so strong in Gaza, that the internet has become a mass surveillance system. I mean, what has happened post-Snowden, of course, is that we're now becoming familiar with quite the level of surveillance. But even that in and of itself, while it's interesting, is perhaps even more pertinent when we consider, as we have been doing with IBRAZ, and I should say some other members of IBRAZ are here, Rima's here and Laura, and one of the things we've been looking at over the last 5 years is how the narrative of the so-called Arab Spring has unfolded purportedly through the internet, through media. And I remember 2011 in Egypt, the so-called Facebook revolution. Now, personally, if I had shares in Facebook, which I don't, but if I did, I would be positively tumescent at the very idea that somehow Facebook was being associated with this revolutionary force. Because effectively, as I'm sure you all know, when you upload an image to Facebook, you no longer own that image. Facebook owns that image. The narrative, if the narrative of the Arab Spring, which a lot of people argue, has been the first narrative of revolution written through social media and predicated by social media, then the very people that caused that revolution to happen are the very people who do not own the narrative of that revolution, because Facebook owned it, Twitter owned it, Instagram owned it. The privatization of that information and the re-narrativization of that information, the instrumentalization of that information and the repurposing of that information is something that is yet to unfold. Who precisely owns the narrative of the so-called Arab Spring? Who owns the narrative of what's happening presently across the Middle East, specifically in cities such as Gaza and such as Ramallah? And I don't have the answers to that, but based upon the research I've been doing, we certainly don't own that narrative.
That's it.
I think there are kind of a number of issues involved here. I think there is, yes, of course, there is this notion of, yes, the artist or the creator or the designer or the architect or the researcher can come and do something and then use that to their benefit. But I think the question, just going back to the question was, how does digital media or digital tools, virtual tools, how can they help in aid? Now, there is, of course, there is a reality here that we need to face, and the reality is that Gaza is in siege. The fact that in Palestine, and actually as well as many other conditions now, places now in the Middle East, there is a desperate situation. And I think when you are in a desperate situation, you need every tool that you can get hold of in order to externalize, de-isolate yourself, expose you and share your narratives as well as the narratives. I think from the projects that we've been doing, not only our research projects, but our good projects and our good projects that we've been doing with other communities and organizations in Palestine and elsewhere, there would have been no way we would have been able to achieve 60% of it without digital aid. It just would not happen. For a number of reasons. One is the fact that it is, whether we like it, capitalism has it is a contradictory system. When it brings it possibilities as well as taking possibilities away. We're aware, very, very much aware, when we did the digital flower, we're very much aware that there is this thing that, one, you have, you can store so much in your little digital chip, but at the same time, it can be wiped out. However, that was never for us a reason not to use it. When we were setting up, after we did our Gaza workshop in order to develop the idea of reconstruction, we knew that it was going to be impossible for us to go back to Gaza again within the short distance. So we had to set up simply parallel workshops from West Bank while we were setting things up in the West Bank. People in Gaza would set that up, and it was quite successful because it meant that the families were able to have their own designers, their own contractors, appointment and use the system that we were in kind of virtually running it, physically running it in the span. They would be kind of virtually transferring it to do it. But also going beyond this very, very practical, there are other issues. I think it's very important for us to realize that the powerful is always obviously tries to take, use whatever it is in order to. But we should not be, I don't think we should be denied of any source, any tools, any technology that exists for us and for those who are not powerful to be able to challenge power. And I think that's quite important. It may be seen ethical, non-ethical, I don't know, but whatever it is, I think we feel that when we go to places like us and other places which are absent from the map or are being kind of in a way rendered absent or kind of taken out of the Google and every other place, they need that, or they need the latest, they would like to have it, they want to know that, yes, they think it's their power, they can use it. And of course, you know, when you're in Palestine, there's so many, there's three or four, the moment you arrive, you get three or four different messages from different digital media, and you have to decide who's controlling who, which is what NASA's and what their projects were doing, which is pretty realistic, the idea of how do you control your own movement around somewhere which is fragmented in Palestine using a GPS. Mm. How do you take that and use it for your own benefit to actually challenge the power?
Just
to
follow up, NASA is not in. Again, I think it's very important while thinking about contexts like that where the powerful is always trying to render the other or the less powerful as absent, how important it is that the role of the media, but the role of us as practitioners is to make sure that those people who are being absent are rendered again as active, not as passive subjects, that almost like the powerful is acting and they're only in the position of reacting. And that kind of brings me to ask a question also for the audiences, which is something we always question ourselves also as practitioners. Does that mean within this power over that we are facing in the world, especially with the control of the media, does it mean that probably that notion of invisibility and subversion is our only possible scenario to make sure that things on in the right direction? Is this the only way that we can assure that the voice of the invisible is made visible? And if that is the case within this current context and control over Facebook and social media, how long do we need to become invisible? And that does not only apply on media, it applies, I think it tackles every aspect of our daily life. As architects, do we have to stay invisible in order to make things happen as artists, as practitioners, and what does that mean? And if the role of subversion is the only way to get things going, is that then the only way forward? And I'm just going to, I think it might be, there's an incident we always keep facing. We once had a phone call from Al Jazeera TV saying that we hear a lot about the work that you're doing, and it actually sounds really fascinating. Is there any way that you could take us to Palestine and show us one of the iconic buildings that you're doing? And it's kind of like the discussion went to this abrupt end when we're actually trying to explain to the journalists that actually our work is not about iconic buildings. The work is very much about those invisible little hints of possibilities that probably are creators for things to happen, not by us. So we can't claim that where we want to see our customers facilitator and step down. And I think then the discussion went to a dead end, obviously, and the interview did not take place. And that always kept us thinking, and the question is, how long could one stay invisible? And is that the right approach? And how do you assess what is right and what is wrong, and what is good and what is bad, and what is aesthetic and what is not aesthetic within that context? I think it's an aspect that bears a lot of weight that we need as practitioners to think about.
Just one, I suppose, just picking up on that, in a sense, a dilemma one faces when one works in any situation. as to whether there is this sense that being invisible and dealing with awareness and dealing with telling the story, as opposed to drainage, insulation, small acts that we as people involved in the built environment are better placed to do invariably than the volunteers and the people who are trying to do it themselves. I suppose it's a general question whether there is a tension between those two forms of care within the situation that so many of you are working in. We are working. Can you do both?
In terms of invisibility, the whole point at the moment is the lobby and the West are in a process of trying to stamp out even discussion of Palestine. I mean, I don't know whether you've sort of watched the latest thing about anti-Semitism that they're attacking the Labour Party over, and to bring in laws, for instance, against BDS. There is an attempt now to make Palestine invisible because Palestine doesn't come into the discussion. All they're discussing is anti-Zionism, anti-Semitism, and using that to actually accuse people of being anti-Zionist and you're anti-Semitic, but using that as a tool to suppress the whole discussion of Palestine and the occupation and what the Zionism is actually doing. So there's a lot of pressure, even on Facebook and Google, for instance, to actually suppress things on Palestine. I think there's quite a move now of censorship on this whole issue of Palestine in Google, Facebook, and all the sort of major media outlets. So I think there's a terrific struggle now to get this out of invisibility and to get all these ideas out into the open, you know, and to get people talking about, instead of Zionism, and to show what Israel is doing. I mean, the latest, for instance, on Gaza, Lieberman, you know, this fascist foreign minister of Israel, has now said that they will offer to build Gaza a seaport and an airport and you know, have terrific development in Gaza if they stop building tunnels. And the whole idea is to make Palestine impotent. You know, they shouldn't arm themselves. You know, they've got to be totally under the control. And if that doesn't happen, the next war with Gaza will destroy it completely. I mean, this guy's talked about nuking Gaza, you know, using nuclear weapons. So it's a very dangerous situation, you know, that Israel is poised with the backing of America and the US, and as somebody mentioned, at the UN.
I just want to throw it open to the floor now, whether there's questions coming from. Would you again say who you are?
My name is Anwar. I'm a PhD candidate in architecture at the Centre for Urban Conflicts Research at the Department of Architecture at Cambridge University. Just a little comment about the invisibility. Well, the whole notion of the invisibility of the Palestinians has been, I mean, long discussed. Rashid Khalidi once quotes Golda Meir saying that just Palestinians never exist.
There's no such thing as Palestine.
Yeah. And my question is, so when we were, I mean, the ambassador's opening today and the whole idea of cultural resistance is about bringing the Palestinians back to the visible arena, let's say on the international field. But it's also this notion of invisibility is also triggering the current development that we currently see in Palestine. So if we are talking about the cultural resistance, we're talking about taking this cultural resistance to the urban, to our cities, whether we're talking about whether we're talking about Gaza, or we're talking about Ramallah, for example, or we're talking about the West Bank in general. And my question is really related to the kind of who produces this kind of cultural resistance, and if we're claiming that it's really coming from the people, are the people aware of it? Because I know that there has been many initiatives taking place in Ramallah, for example. Kalandia International is one of them. Ramallah Syndrome a few years ago was also one of them. A current competition, an exhibition by Qatan Foundation in Ramallah about yoga artists. So there has been all these initiatives to raise a bit of awareness about the cultural scene in Palestine. But how about the local people? I mean, are people aware of it? Because do you have to be well-educated in order to understand what's going on in the cultural scene? Do you have to visit a certain gallery and read the description of a certain project in order to understand what's happening? So that's one question. Another question is how is this really being placed with the larger agenda of the government to build the Palestinian state? Is this being endorsed by the government? One, is this being funded by the government? Two, and three, does it fit with the current state building project of the Palestinian Authority?
So,
I can answer part of that or have a go at it. I think the are the people consulted in relation to cultural projects is a really interesting one, and I think in I have things to say about two different contexts. I've taught at the Art Academy in Ramallah, where I have seen international curators come in looking for the Palestinian artist who can somehow fulfill their Orientalist dream of what a Palestinian artist should be, and that artist is somehow, there's a pressure then to produce a certain type of work for the hunger of the buyers in the art fairs or wherever, who kind of want to fulfill something of their own distant understanding of there. So there's a huge problem there in my understanding. And in other places, my own experience of working with Birzeit University and working on this project called Cities Exhibition, which happens again around every 2 years, was very much about taking the cultural production out of from beyond the walls of a white space, and into the communities, and really, really creating a dialogue between the people and the artist, and coming up with something that was very inclusive. Whether it was a meal, whether it was something that was a shared, that had to, somehow there was a shared moment, which also could bring up its own problems in that it was never necessarily equal, but there was an attempt to break down some of those walls and to create a dialogue and to discuss what might actually be useful. Also working in the field of architecture, Yazid Anani, I've worked with a lot, and he is someone who does work a great deal with the government, with trying to set up initiatives I've disappeared, Abbas and everybody. He and the people he works with are very much into building bridges between the people and imagining possibilities of a beyond what is the neoliberal situation that is there now. So I don't know, that's a few things about that.
Anwar?
Yeah.
I think the question you ask about do people on the ground know what's happening in their name is an interesting question. But there's another question one could ask here, which is potentially as interesting. Since when have we come to believe that a cultural initiative can change anything? And I ask that question because there is, and I'm sure you know this, the potential that culture becomes instrumentalized to political ends. And that is the de facto project of neoliberalism, whereby culture will be co-opted and instrumentalized to answer to political priorities rather than oppose political priorities. And we had precisely a similar situation in this country for 20 years under the project of multiculturalism, whereby debates around so-called race, ethnicity, and difference were deferred from a political context and referred into a cultural context where they were effectively managed. And they were managed by institutions that increasingly became part of a technocratic bureaucratization of this problematic. And it seems to me increasingly, and I could be wrong, that in the Middle East in particular, and specifically in Palestine, culture has been used in a similar way to manage difference, to manage dissensus, to manage problems, in a way that answer to the political priorities of the IMF, answer to the political priorities of a neoliberal project, answer to the political priorities of, indeed, the IDF, rather than, in many ways, using culture to be antagonistic, to create a dissensual politics, whereby they question precisely why we've come to rely upon culture to solve political problems. Those problems are political problems, largely, historical and social. They need to be solved at the United Nations. They need to be solved in political arenas. And culture seems to be sent increasingly as a sort of buffer zone for not solving those problems.
May I answer also just one thing about the Palestinian Authority? I think it's a very important point, is the system or is the is the authority, how much is it involved? I think the answer, and that's my personal view, and probably an approach that we're doing, I think it is very important that one should work on two levels. And I don't think anywhere should wait for an authority to give, to legitimize it. And if we are believing that the community should take role and come back to the front line, which they used to have a very strong role during the Intifada, for example, and before, then any artwork should bear in mind that it has to become a way that brings the community back to the front line, and we have to accumulate. And we have to allow also for probably testing and experimentation, but I think it's that ongoing process of accumulation that gives the community a chance to come forward is what counts, rather than waiting whoever is going to take it forward. Now, if we can work on both levels, that's obviously the, probably the extreme point of power that one could achieve. But meanwhile, probably the priority should be working with the community. That's probably our own approach as practicing architects and academics. So we start from the street, and then whatever we can reach above that is great from our priorities.
Unfortunately, there just isn't enough work in Gaza, though, or artists being encouraged in Gaza. And it's so many books and articles and work about Gaza and in exhibitions around the world and not in Gaza itself. So they're hungry for it, and they're asking, well, we don't have the opportunities. And one of them might be chosen to go to Ramallah for an exhibition, and they try, and then that creates another power rift between the West Bank and Gaza, which is becoming increasingly divided, where Gazan artists are not nurtured. And so we need to think about actually making work, in finding ways to make work in Gaza for the people, with the artists, with the local communities.
Can I just return it just for a moment to an architectural conversation, because we're talking about forms of artistic practice, curation, and just ask Matt, in terms of the teaching of architecture and the making of an architectural education, what is the role of stuff that you can inhabit, kick, physical interventions, architectural interventions? Because we haven't spoken about those at all today.
I suppose it's very interesting hearing this debate, because one of my big problems with education across the board is the duality in the way that we're taught. There's good, there's bad, and if there's beautiful, there's ugly. And that's partly, when Anthony showed that photograph by Ai Weiwei, it eventually found its way into a frame in a gallery, which immediately says to me, well, actually, that's distanced itself from the people, the everyday person. In terms of the architectural education, we made a deliberate act, say, at Brooks. There's a couple of things spinning around my head as well about the Human Rights Fest we ran last year, which is kind of irrelevant to this. But bringing Nasser and Yara in, they took the students to Palestine. It sounds like a very important part, it is the most critical part, so they actually met the people they're designing for. And Max Hutchison, who used to be the president of the RIBA, asked a very good question once, which was when we had all the carbuncle high-rise blocks thing, would you design a piece of architecture that you weren't prepared to live in yourself? I think that's a really good relevant question to the students, because Part of the issue with the higher education is to allow the students to make themselves self-aware or produce their own self-image. And so they actually start to evolve ethics and morals as they start to study. Now, Nasha and Yara have had a huge impact on that at postgraduate level, but at Brooks we also brought it at an undergraduate level, and it's a completely different bag. It's completely different. You cannot allow somebody, say, of 19, 20 years old who's been educated in the Western society primarily to try and get their heads around the complexities of the Palestinian problem. They have to take it in increments up to working on the postgraduate level, which surprised me. I thought they'd be open to anything, but actually we had to start with a project in Coventry. Homeless people in Coventry and start to build it in, so they started to understand the research level. So Palestine is so complex, whereas Coventry isn't quite as complex. I mean, when you guys have been talking today, it's been great, because, I mean, it's not my area of thing, but then I was thinking about the, last year we had the Human Rights Festival. We have it every year in February, March time. That's a sort of, it's a prompt as well, so if you're off Oxford, February, March, come to the Human Rights Festival. But we also had a complaint last year. We had a complaint that this is a Palestinian-focused exhibition, and the complaint was levied in June.
By whom?
The local, some kind of local Israeli society or something.
Yeah, the students.
But what was interesting was that they levelled the complaint in June. The academic year doesn't start till September, and the exhibition's not till March. So I was approached by my VC and said, well, actually, is this a Palestinian-focused exhibition? And I actually said, I don't know yet. It's a student-run exhibition, and they don't start till September. So the propaganda outweighed that. But then it had an increment in it, which was about Palestinian tapestries, which Salam, that you saw on the Skype, was very incremental in actually bringing part on. And the university was quite resistant to that until one of our main benefactors supported it, and then it kind of was easily accepted. So what tells you is that, I mean, it's kind of a really obvious example of you can't just sit on the sidelines and shout from the outside looking in. You've got to work on the inside. So by actually bringing in the benefactor, we actually got the Palestinian part of the exhibition, which meant that then we got the great and the good to be made aware of this exhibition as well. And that's down to the students primarily. The students made people aware of that. So we did present these Palestinian tapestries, and everybody wanted to know the story behind them. So it started a dialogue, started a debate. Where it goes, like who interprets it and how they interpret it, is up to them. I just think we promoted live projects a lot. I think students getting out and about and actually seeing it face to face is important. At Oxford Brookes, I only speak for Oxford Brookes, I think probably in the region of 90% of students when they start have never been outside Europe. And I think that's an issue. They should actually be going beyond the realms of Europe. I don't particularly mean put them into dangerous situations, but making them more aware by travel. So that would be my thing. I mean, my main premise in teaching is about historical narrative, whereas my brother's into philosophical philosophy, so we have two very different camps about how we understand the world. And it's just by understanding different people's camps. But again, we're in a privileged position. Sorry, Robert, went on a bit.
I'm not going to answer. I'm going to take one more question from the floor before Michael Sorkin sums up.
I'm Esme Rothwell. I'm a student of Nasser and Yara's. I think it's my comment is in light of this discussion about data, the effects of kind of, well, the effect of a artistic or cultural intervention, and how it can sort of help to have some sort of adjacent agency in Palestine. So I'm doing my architectural thesis on data centers, and what is curious is the fact that you mentioned that there was such a strong network in Gaza, and surely that's kind of based on sort of the fiber optic cables. So if it's a place under siege, then how can they install those fiber optic cables that are so strong yet so invisible? That's one question, and maybe I don't know whether anyone can answer that or whether it's just a engineering question or not. Another thing is, if you have ownership over everyone thinks that it's just some sort of mysterious cloud. They never say where it's going to go. It ends up in the data center. It ends up in just a black box somewhere. Nobody cares about it. No one wants it in their backyard. It's just there in a server. So how come... But you wouldn't? Would you build a data center in a place that's under siege? I don't know. But I think sort of a data center itself is just completely culturally sort of devoid of any kind of... it is devoid of culture because it's just a box. So the thing is, I suppose my question is about the network. Why is it so strong? And how can you sort of instantiate this ownership of this proliferating sort of surge of, you know, the way that people communicate? How can you kind of capture that? I don't know if that makes any sense.
I'm not sure either.
We can help you with your brief.
Bear in mind is that we only have electricity 8,000.
Yeah, I was about to say, there are a few
pragmatical... limits your connectivity.
Yeah, and the control over that electricity supply.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
Australia's can turn it up or down as they like.
And be cautious about assuming that a data centre is culturally neutral, because its culture is defined by its contents. And if its contents are of a particular place, then that gives
about
it a culture.
More architecturally, because I visited a data centre, that's why. So it's just racks, it's just servers, and that's pretty much it. So yeah, that's kind of my problem.
Yeah, culture and aesthetics are often conflated and confused, aren't they? Just something to think of.
Yeah, I mean it's.
Thank you. I think we're going to draw it to a close. And I think, NASA, have we got Michael talking on air?
Yes. Really?
But thank you very much. I suppose my only question would be, I just wonder what's been happening to the unaccompanied kids in Calais while we've all been here for the last 3 hours.
Yeah.
It'd be very interesting to find out. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanks, Robert.
Thank you.